Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Welcome to Straight No Chaser on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We are broadcasting live from the studios of Roberta's in Bushwick, where brunch is being served at 261 Moore Street. My guest today is the eminent attorney, Bill Marler, from Marler Clark Law Firm. Bill is a primary rock star in food litigation. I don't know what else to say. I have a whole bio. I'm going to read that. And then Bill, you will be grilled accordingly. Bill Marler is the managing partner of the law firm Marler & Clark, a nationally recognized expert in food safety. Mr. Marler began representing victims of foodborne illness in 1993 when he represented the most seriously injured survivor of the Jack in the Box E. coli 0157H7 outbreak. And since then, he has represented thousands of victims of foodborne illness, including Stephanie Smith, the subject of the Pulitzer Prize-winning story in the New York Times Magazine about E. coli contamination. Mr. Marler's advocacy for a safer food supply includes petitioning the United States Department of Agriculture to better regulate pathogenic E. coli, working with nonprofit food safety and foodborne illness victims organizations, and helping to spur the passage of the 2010-2011 FDA Food Safety Modernization Act. So, Bill, you have quite the CV there. How did you get into the whole foodborne illness thing? Was that what you expected to do when you hopped out of law school, or did it just kind of fall in your lap and interest you?
Well, it was, I had planned to be a trial lawyer and was doing that kind of work when the Jack in the Box case happened here in the state of Washington. Mm-hmm. Seattle was really the epicenter of that outbreak. It was in January of 1993, Seattle was really a war zone. They were flying in dialysis machines from other cities because there were so many kids in need of dialysis that right. Seattle didn't have enough equipment. It was, it was incredible.
How many people were affected by that outbreak?
There were a total of 600 people sickened. Four children died.
Yikes.
About 50 kids developed a syndrome called hemolytic uremic syndrome, which is acute mm-hmm. kidney failure.
Right.
It was a really horrible experience, for everyone. And it was really, the first time that a foodborne illness outbreak sort of caught the attention of the public.
Well, it was heavily reported in the media, and I guess partly because Jack in the Box was such a big deal at that point in the fast food industry, and I think partly because kids were so adversely affected. I don't think that had been reported so much in the past. By the way, that HUS syndrome that you just described was also a big feature of the E. coli outbreak in Germany from Sprouts this year,
right.
And in a new and apparently more virulent strain or something. I mean, somehow that sort of eclipsed the Jack in the Box case in a little bit, didn't it?
Oh, by
by an order multiple. Of magnitude. Yeah, yeah.
E. coli, the E. coli 0157H7, which was the type of bug that hit on the Jack in the Box case, has a lot of nasty cousins.
Right.
Some are emerging pathogens. Some have probably been around, but we haven't been able to have the technology to detect it. We are seeing an increase in what we call non-0157 mm-hmm. Shigatoxin-producing E. coli, and the German outbreak was one of those.
Right. In the current news, we're going to go back to that whole sort of emerging pathogen business and a few other related matters. But right now, I've seen a lot of media coverage in the Huffington Post and elsewhere about arsenic in apple juice. And since you're the man, tell us what that's all about and how much should people be worried, especially about their kids?
Well, one of the things that's happened over time is there's sort of two converging problems. One is, and being here in the state of Washington, I have a lot of experience with apples.
I would bet.
It used to be where all the apples were grown, but over time that's not been the case. And we are getting more and more of our cheap apple juice from imports. And in part, either because of organic or inorganic arsenic, and inorganic is much more problematic, that really comes from pesticides. We're starting to see that Food and Water Watch and mm-hmm. Consumer Reports have done some, you know, really good research on what they're finding in imported apple juice. And arsenic is a known carcinogen.
Yeah.
The FDA says it's presently in levels that are not to be overly concerned about, but I noticed in the last week that Mike Taylor is starting to ease on that, and I think that's a good sign.
Ease in the sense that he's saying that actually this isn't so great and these are potentially dangerous levels?
Yeah, I think they're going to start really looking at whether it's organic or inorganic arsenic, and frankly whether or not they need to spend more time paying attention to how much is in it. Of course, I have a firm belief that, we need to produce our own food, but, making apple juice here might be slightly more expensive, but, if I had little kids, I'd be much more, interested in, getting apple juice from the U.S.
Absolutely. Well, how can we protect ourselves from products that are coming in from overseas that might be contaminated? I mean, it seems like over and over again, you read, the pine nuts from Turkey and, the apple juice and milk products. And I mean, all of this stuff that's coming in from overseas, isn't anybody minding the store?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One is, and I say that this is probably counterintuitive, but, in 20 years of handling nearly every foodborne illness outbreak that's occurred, the vast majority of the foodborne illness outbreaks have been caused by products grown in the United States.
Uh-huh. So, interesting.
Imports are are an issue, and they're a growing issue. We have this tendency to sort of chase the cheapest product, that has, potentially negative implications. The FDA now has stations in many of our trading partners' countries, which is a really pretty unique thing that we have inspectors overseas in those countries. But, they're grossly, understaffed and underfunded, especially in China.
Right. Well, yeah. But those other countries have their inspectors here. I mean, we're always getting knocked off of the meat wagon, as it were,
right,
by other countries that, decide that they're going to ban our product because, such and such a plant hasn't come up to their safety standards or whatever. So it's obviously a two-way street on that score. And I'm glad to hear that we've actually started to step up and put people into place where they should be. There are major cuts on food safety programs that are being contemplated by Congress right now. What's going to happen if some of those cuts to the FDA budget or the USDA budget go into place? Will we lose inspectors like that and other personnel involved in food safety?
Whether we lose them overseas, I think they will probably hold our own there, primarily mm-hmm. because even though it's less of a risk overseas, perhaps, than it is, on our own turf. It's easier to justify having inspectors overseas than they are at home. And again, that's primarily because I think people are more concerned about imports. The biggest problem is that there are many things in the Food Safety Modernization Act that are mandatory, where the law is requiring the FDA to do things, but at the same time, you're not adding to the, you know, the employment base at FDA. And it's just, you know, you're going to stretch this, you know, the agency thinner and thinner and thinner, and they're just going to, frankly, not be able to do the job that they intended, you know, to do.
Right. I'm going to take like a literally a 10 second break here to kind of pull myself together and let other people pull themselves together. And we'll come right back with Bill Marler, the attorney who is behind much of the Food Safety Modernization Act and much of the, you know, coverage about food safety in this country. Okay, we're on Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and on the phone with me is Bill Marler of the Marler Clark Law Firm, a law firm that has been responsible for prosecuting some of the major foodborne illness outbreak cases in the United States. Bill, thanks so much again for joining us. This is our second segment, and I want to talk all about meat, because actually that's my favorite subject. So we were mentioning earlier, you know, the strains that are coming up in E. coli, and the American Meat Institute is having a hissy fit about the idea of implementing what they call the big six, inspecting for what they call the big six, which are E. coli, O157H7, plus those other five strains that are more increasingly behind foodborne illness outbreaks. So what's going to happen? Are they saying, are they right in saying that these inspections are just going to cost them more money and not going to shut the stats down in any greater degree than they already are? Or are they just basically protecting themselves as usual?
Well, I think let's put this a little bit in context.
Okay.
You know, the in 1994, after the Jack in the Box E. coli outbreak, a familiar name, Mike Taylor, who instead of being at FDA was at FSIS, so the mm-hmm. USDA arm, he, with the nod of President Clinton, declared E. coli 0157H7 an adulterant.
Right.
And that dramatically changed the landscape of meat safety in this country. It took some time for it to work through the system, but the numbers of ill people linked to E. coli 0157 have fallen off dramatically. The industry didn't like it. They sued. They, you know, screamed and yelled. But the bottom line is that, you know, it has worked and has worked well and has saved them hundreds of millions of dollars over time.
I would think so. I mean, I don't understand why you wouldn't want to inspect for everything you could in order to avoid these disastrous lawsuits.
Well, you know, part of it is that, you know, when an organization like the American Meat Institute is created, they have to continue to justify their existence. And if they didn't fight things, they wouldn't seem to be relevant to their members.
I see.
And I think sometimes they just fight for fighting's sake. And so you come to, you know, in this decade, and Elizabeth Hagen, who's now head of FSIS, mm-hmm. when she was sort of further down the food chain, saw that E. coli, non-0157, other shigatoxin-producing E. coli, were eclipsing 0157 as by like a factor of two, as the number of people getting sick in this country. So we know that there are about 75,000 people getting sick from E. coli 0157, and that has held steady for about two decades, even though our population increases. So we actually have done better there. But at the same time, these other E. coli's, the big six, have gotten to be about 125,000 people are sick every year. So Hagen went to her boss, guy in the Bush administration, Dick Raymond, and said, you know, we need to do something. And that was the start of, you know, the work towards a an adulterant label for these other bacteria. I petitioned FSIS in October of 2009, and just in the last few months, they agreed with the petition, and they're going to start requiring that these bugs be adulterants and start being tested in March. I think the AMI is just doing what it does, and mm-hmm. you know, just causing you know some consternation. But it's not going to be you know inexpensive for the industry to do it. That's just part of you know food safety is not an inexpensive thing to do. But in the long run, it's going to be helpful to the American public and ultimately helpful to the bottom line of the meat industry.
I would think so. Speaking of the expense of implementing these inspection processes or additional inspection processes, companies like Cargill or Tyson or National Beef, they can afford to put all of these you know, measures into place because they have so much, you know, they just have sure. so much money. But if you're a smaller plant, how do you manage? I mean, are they going to, will the FDA give them a pass on some of these inspection measures? Or are they going to, are more small plants going to go out of business because of this? What's the impact going to be on the smaller part of the food chain?
Well, I certainly hope two things. One is I hope that the USDA doesn't cut small plants slack when it comes to food safety. Secondly, I don't think they need it. And the, you know, the what is going to be required is nothing more than what is being required now, except for additional testing. And you know, whether you're a small plant or a large plant, the testing protocols are relatively the same, and they're relatively inexpensive. Mm-hmm. And if you find a pathogenic bacteria in your facility, you'll want to not sell that product, and whether you're a small facility or a large facility.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality, too, is that the smaller the facility doesn't mean that it doesn't have any risk of foodborne pathogens getting in their product. But the smaller the facility, the fewer cows that are being you know, ground up to put in a hamburger, the less likely it is that that product is going to be contaminated. You know, the more, you know, cows you put into a pound of hamburger, the greater the likelihood is that, you know, one of them has got a problem.
Yep.
And that's just, a, you know, a function of, you know, the manufacturing process. So I'm less concerned about small manufacturers because I think, you know, they can you know, differentiate themselves by the big players by A, testing aggressively, and you know, frankly, most consumers would pay the you know couple pennies more a pound if they knew that their product was A, local, B, small, and C, tested regularly.
Yeah, I certainly would. Well, let's, Carlos, I'm going to take like another 10-second break here. We'll be back right back with Bill Marler of Marler Clark Attorney Law Firm in Seattle, Washington. This is Straight No Chaser, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Straight No Chaser. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's on heritageradionetwork.com. My guest on the phone is Bill Marler of the Marler Clark Law Firm, one of the firms, or probably the premier firm that litigates on food safety and foodborne illness cases. Bill, thanks so much again. Let's talk about subtherapeutic antibiotic use. There's really no end. Can I tell right now, there's no end to the topics. I mean, if I could keep you on here for the rest of the day, I would. And I really hope you'll come back.
No, let's do it. We'll do it again.
Because
I'm traveling so much, you know, I've been doing so many speeches to companies all over the world, sort of trying to pitch on why it's a bad idea to poison your customers, but it's sometimes hard to get the landline. So.
Yeah, well, we'll make it happen, and we don't have to do it on a Sunday. I could always pre-record. But anyway, let's get right down to business with my favorite subject right now, which is subtherapeutic antibiotic use in livestock
right.
production. I read, you know, all the trade blogs, and
right.
I am just stunned over and over again by the resistance in the industry to the idea of abandoning subtherapeutic antibiotic use. But clearly, it is becoming more and more of a health hazard to humans. So what's going to happen?
Well, A, I agree with you. You know, B, there are enormous competing, you know, agendas. You know, some are, you know, understandable. Some just perplex you. I think the first thing is we all have to agree that sub-therapeutic usage of, you know, antibiotics in, you know, food animals is impacting human health, because there are antibiotic-resistant salmonellas, at least four.
Yeah.
There's antibiotic-resistant campylobacters, and there's a lot of research out there about other bugs like, you know, MRSA and others that, you know, still have not been necessarily linked to food, but there are certainly some, you know, issues surrounding them. You know, we have inside of CDC this group called NARMS, which has been, you know, working with physicians, you know, all over the United States, sort of trying to raise this issue. So I think the science, you know, says we really need to pay attention to it, and we really need to cut back the usage, because, you know, antibiotics are important for human health, period. Then you have veterinarians who sort of look at animal health, and they see the use of antibiotics, even subtherapeutic usage of antibiotics, as something that is good for animal health. And you can understand where they're coming from when these animals live in confined areas and, mm-hmm. you know, they're trying to keep animals healthy.
Yep.
Of course, then you have the, you know, the use of antibiotics. They're not really growth enhancers, but they're health enhancers to allow the animals to be, to grow in those kinds of environments.
And, I and think to it's grow just, faster.
Yeah, and it's one of those things I think we fundamentally have to look at how we feed, you know, a growing population, and both in the United States and abroad, where especially as countries become, you know, economically advantaged, you know, meat consumption is skyrocketing.
Yes.
It's a very complex issue, but I think one of the things that, you know, has to be sort of put at the forefront is, you know, long-term human health. And, you know, that to me makes it, you know, the thing that we have to start really doing, you know, in this decade. And, you know, driving down the use of therapeutic antibiotics is, you know, something that's going to have to happen. And there is some slight movement afoot. We've seen some positive movement even by industry. I mean, recently, Cargill recalled salmonella-tainted turkey, even though it was not linked to illnesses.
Yeah, but it was tainted with Salmonella Heidelberg, which is one of those
absolutely
antibiotic-resistant
The fact that they recalled it without illnesses, because technically they, you know, technically the government says that it's frankly perfectly fine to have antibiotic-resistant salmonella in your turkey or in your hamburger. This is salmonella, antibiotic-resistant salmonella is not, strangely enough, an adulterant like E. coli 0157.
Fascinating, because, I mean, you know, why one particular strain?
Oh, no,
microorganism is deemed an adulterant and another is not.
Yeah, it's completely nonsensical.
Yeah.
And actually, if you then, I'll give you an example. If you have salmonella, antibiotic-resistant salmonella in hamburger, it's perfectly fine to sell it to you. Mm. If you have salmonella in lettuce, you can't sell it. It's considered an adulterant.
Well, but you're not going to cook the lettuce. And I think, I mean, what the meat papers
right.
always say in the meat trade blogs, they always blame the consumer. It's always, well, they didn't cook it to 165 degrees. They didn't
right.
cook it to 185 degrees. So it's always on the consumer. They didn't wash their cutting boards. They didn't wash their hands, whatever it is.
Well, the
industry is
the
bound
meat
to...
And the cantaloupe growers, it's always, you know, everybody wants, you know, sort of, I think it's some kind of bizarre human nature to want to blame everybody else for your problems. But the reality is that, and why E. coli 0157 is an adulterant, is that the government and, frankly, industry understands that, you know, cooking hamburger is one of those things that consumers do, but handling it, how you put it in your grocery cart, how you handle it when it gets into your kitchen. You really have to be, a rocket scientist in many respects to handle, highly contaminated, antibiotic resistant. It just doesn't doesn't comport with reality.
God. I mean, it's just reading your food safety journal and the food poison journal. I mean, Bill, I'm like turning into a paranoid freak. I'll be eating nothing but GMO alfalfa before you know
well,
it.
Well, I think there are some, common sense. There's common sense. And, people ask me all the time. In fact, I was at a Christmas party last evening and I bet you 10 people ask me, what do you eat? What do you don't eat? Oh, my God, what about this? What about that? Oh, my, really? Cantaloupe now?
Yeah.
And, I think there's a lot of common sense things that consumers can do to protect themselves and their family and most importantly, use their pocketbook to help change corporate and, food producer behavior.
Ooh, well, Bill, that is going to have to be an entire program in and of itself because
I'd love to come back for that.
Oh my God. Well, I hope you'll also want to come back to talk about raw milk. And let's not forget
that will
about
get a lot of that'll get a lot of interest.
Especially in the epicenter.
Very passionate thing.
Yeah, well, we're in the epicenter of hipsterdom here in Bushwick,
yes.
Brooklyn. So you can imagine
yes.
that raw milk is probably really popular. Not
yes.
with me. For me, pasteurization came about for a very good reason.
Yeah.
I'm all for it, just as I am all for vaccinating your children against the basic childhood diseases. And I actually was reading today on your food safety journal that more and more
right.
people are opting out of that. It's not the first place I've seen it, but
right.
it just blows my mind that, it
right.
just shows how long it's been since we had any major outbreaks of things like polio or mumps or something like that where children were at risk or died. And these fools are just like, oh, it's not going to happen to me.
Well, not to take their argument, but part of what's going on is, and this is sort of my view, is that part of it is that consuming public doesn't trust the companies that are producing food,
right.
and doesn't trust the government to protect them, and so they tend to kind of keep moving further and further out on the edge to sort of protect themselves, and there's a lot of opportunities for misinformation.
Yes.
And I think that's what happens with vaccines and raw milk. And people are trying to figure out how to protect themselves, and they don't feel like industry and the government is there to help them. And I think that's a failing on the part of industry and the government to do the things that they need to do to make sure the public, trust them. There's a lack of trust, and that is much of a problem, in my view, when it comes to consumers doing things that we think are a little bit, unsafe and unhealthy.
Yeah, I think that's a glorious point. I really appreciate that you made that. I think that's exactly spot on. And we can probably trace it right back to Watergate, which is where I think the distrust of government really came from. No, really. I mean, that's
absolutely.
When we started thinking.
I'm old enough to know that.
Right?
Right.
Yeah, well, you and I think, are more or less the same age. I'm probably older yeah. than you are. But anyway, so unfortunately, we have to wrap this up. Alas, alack. I want you to name your favorite blogs that you write or that your company is responsible for, Food Safety Journal being one of them. I subscribe to that. And then I just recently subscribed to Food Poison. What is it? Food Poison Journal?
Yeah, my favorite one, and it's only because, I'm so egomaniacal, is Marler blog.
Oh, yeah.
And that's when
I thank you for saying
health.
That.
And you and my mother could be subscribers. But actually, what's
and
interesting
Ben Hewitt's
is
mom.
My blog, Marler blog, has the American Bar Association and LexisNexis have both put it in their top 10 of law blogs, which, considering mm-hmm. that those entities are sort of more corporate-owned than not, it's pretty much a nice little pat on my back to have them listed, and I think it's actually making people pay more attention to this area of the law, which I think is really needed.
It's clearly a growing field.
Yes.
I hate to say it, but
fortunately, we all have to eat, and
yeah.
we all want to eat things that don't kill us.
Right. Well, I think that, I mean, the localization of food and re-regionalization of food systems and so on will probably go a long way towards addressing some of these issues. But you and I will be talking about that on a future broadcast. For the meantime, I want to thank you very, very much for being my guest today. Folks, if you you know, tune in anytime, you can listen to the show on our archives or on our download it on iTunes. Sorry to be so incoherent. And Bill, we'll send you a link to the show afterwards. And
okay,
I'll be talking to Suzanne tomorrow to book my next gig with you.
Okay.
Thanks
right.
again,
thank
man.
You so much.
Take care. And thank you,
bye-bye.
Folks, for listening to Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I wish I could tell you who my guest was going to be next week, but they bowed out. So I'm scrambling. But I swear, I promise, it'll be somebody really interesting, almost as good as Bill Marler. See you then. Bye bye.
Thank you.
This is a message from Vegan Pop-Up Shop. Looking for the perfect holiday gift for that special vegan in your life? Come down to the Vegan Holiday Shop-Up Sunday, December 4th from 12 to 5 p.m. at the Pine Box Rock Shop in Bushwick. There you'll find a wide array of vegan-friendly treats, eats, fashions, and home goods. From soy wax candles to homemade hot sauce, the Vegan Holiday Shop-Up has your vegan present needs covered. So come down early and stay late and enjoy a spicy Bloody Mary while you're there, and maybe leave with something extra for yourself. Following is a message from Jones Family Farms. Looking for that perfect Christmas tree this season? What about the perfect wine to go with your holiday dinner? Look no further than Jones Family Farm, a 400-acre working farm in Connecticut. Jones Family Farms is as passionate about education as it is about farming. Whether you're picking fresh strawberries or exploring local wines, we hope you're inspired to learn more about Connecticut farming. For more information, visit www.jonesfamilyfarms.com.